you know, I thought I had a pretty good understanding of what the job's all about, having been at it for a couple of years now. But this law student came up to me and he said, "Wow, you are so lucky you get to sue Christians."
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, find out why folks at the American Humanist Association really do get paid to sue Christians, and figure out, finally, how to pronounce Avignani Humanist Legal Center. This year, the American Humanist Association's Avignani Humanist Legal Center celebrates a decade of service. The center provides legal assistance to defend the constitutional rights of religious and secular minorities by directly challenging clear violations of the Establishment Clause and seeking equal rights for humanists, atheists, and other free thinkers. Through a combination of staff and pro bono attorneys, the center engages in amicus activity, litigation, and other legal advocacy. This May, at the American Humanist Association's annual conference, David Niosi, legal director for the center, and Monica Miller, senior counsel, spoke about the center. They talked about its victories and challenges and the cases in front of it today. Their discussion is presented here for those interested in the mission of the Avignani Humanist Legal Center. It has been modified slightly for this format, and the question and answer period has been truncated. To hear the full Q&A, please watch the panel video on the American Humanist Association's YouTube channel.
Thanks for being here. I'm Rob Boston. I serve on the board of the American Humanist Association. Humanists have a long and distinguished track record of being involved in the courts to defend the separation of church and state, freedom of conscience, and other human rights. In fact, if you go back and look at some of the prominent church-state cases that reached the U.S. Supreme Court over the past 60 years, oftentimes the plaintiff will be someone who identifies as a humanist, an atheist, an agnostic, a free thinker. So we've been involved for a long time. And today, the American Humanist Association, through the Avignani Humanist Legal Center, continues that fine tradition of activism in the courts, filing cases directly, being involved in amicus briefs, and other ways to help people secure their rights in courts when everything else has failed. Sometimes that's what you have to do. Go to court and stand up for your rights. David Niosi, the legal director of the center, and Monica Miller, the legal counsel of the center, are going to discuss this important work with us, fill us in on all the cases that the AHA has been involved in, and let us know about the fine tradition of humanist activism in the courts.
Thank you, Rob. Hi, everyone. So everyone having a good time? Great, yeah. Let's hear it for the AHA staff for putting together this wonderful conference, huh? I really have no idea how they do it, Roy and Maggie. You know, think about it for a minute. You know, we're going to have a conference, and we're just going to have a Pulitzer Prize-winning author come and talk to us, and nothing to it. Put together all these wonderful speakers. It's really fantastic. So anyway, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Legal Center, and Monica Miller is going to speak as well. We'll talk about some of the things we've been up to. It's an interesting job doing the Legal Center work, I will tell you that. I was speaking at a law school a few weeks ago, and I thought I had a pretty good understanding of what the job's all about, having been at it for a couple of years now. But this law student came up to me and he said, "Wow, you are so lucky you get to sue Christians." And I thought about that, and I never really considered my job in that way, but he's absolutely right, because I think every single defendant in our cases is a fundamentalist Christian or conservative Christian. We would gladly sue Muslims and Jews and Hindus, but for some reason they don't seem to be attacking the wall of separation the way that the Christian right does. So It's true. Well, that's our job. Monica and I, we sue Christians. Anyway, we hope to give you a good overview of our activities at the Apigiani Humanist Legal Center, where we've been, where we are now, and where we're going. Our legal center has now been around for a decade, believe it or not, and we've really come a long way. We're very proud of where we're at. In the early days, the legal center, if you've been around the AHA long enough, really kind of had an academic feel to it, I would say. The center's main activity at the very beginning was basically a newsletter providing an overview and a useful, helpful overview of church-state developments to those who received it. In recent years, it's a much different atmosphere, to be sure. We've really transformed the center into what I would describe as a litigation shop. That's what we do. The atmosphere is not so much academic at all, but more like the feel of a real practicing law firm, because that's what we are, a small litigation-oriented law firm. We don't so much talk about legal developments. We advocate in court for church-state separation and the rights of humanists and other secular Americans. Our center is now contacted every day by people inquiring about church-state violations in their communities. And believe me, there's a lot of them out there. The AHA has become one of the few go-to church-state organizations, watchdog groups in this country. I would say especially for young people, and that's really thanks to the brilliant strategizing of AHA leadership in reaching out to young people and letting them know that they have rights in this country. Young secular Americans, and as we all know if we follow the demographic trends, young secular Americans are very much aware that they have rights, and they are reaching out to the AHA to protect them. So that's all great stuff, and I want to get into it in a little bit of detail with you. The first thing I'll do is show you a slide that violates everything about what a good PowerPoint presentation should be, because it's all words. But I needed all that space to show you what we've been up to. These are developments, what I would say recent notable developments on the litigation front that we've seen in the last couple of years or so. And I'm not going to go into each one of these in great detail because time prevents it. But as you can see, we've been all over the country. Rankin, Mississippi, not only did we go down there and get a consent decree against a school system that was violating church state, we came back and we filed a contempt against them for violating that consent decree. And we beat them twice. So that's still alive. And I'd point out that they still might not have learned their lesson. So we may be regulars down in Rankin. I may get an apartment down there or something. So that consent decree is still alive and still being violated from time to time. Hall County, Georgia, we went after a school system there, reached a settlement agreement. Their sports program in particular was just over the top with its Christianity. In California, there was a monument that was planned that had Christian imagery on it. So we prevented that from going up before it did by running into court, and we got a judgment for the plaintiffs on that. In Oregon, this is really a very notable case, and really some remarkable work by Monica on this one. We got a consent decree for a humanist prisoner who wanted to form a humanist group in his prison, a federal prison. And we succeeded in that. We had to deal with the Department of Justice on this. So it was the AHA against the Department of Justice. Talk about, you know, David and Goliath. But not only did we get that, but at one point in the negotiations, Monica came to me and she said, you know, I think maybe we should try to see if the prison will not only allow this humanist group, but we should have them recognize humanism throughout the entire federal prison system from coast to coast in what's called the sentry system. Now, I've been practicing about 25 years, and you know, I have a pretty good sense of what's realistic and what's not. But I figure in my position, I should not be, you know, snuffing out the big goals of someone who hasn't been practicing quite as long as I have. So she said to me, you know, what do you think? And I said, well, yeah, you know, go for it. You know, and I have to tell you the honest truth is I'm thinking, good luck. Well, you know, a few days later, she comes back. She says, you know what? They said okay. So now in the United States of America, throughout the entire Bureau of Prisons, if there are any people wishing to identify as humanist, they may do so. Thanks to the fine work of Monica and the Legal Center. It's really, and I have to say, the reason why the Department of Justice was so willing to negotiate with us and see things our way was really the quality of the legal work that it went into it. We don't just file a boilerplate complaint or boilerplate motions. Our legal work really did show them that we meant business, and they obviously saw it. So they came to the table. Fayette, Missouri is another case where we got a consent decree against a school system. Baxter, Arkansas, they're putting up a nativity scene that violated church state. We got that taken down after it had been up many, many years, got a judgment. Pittsburgh, we got a consent decree on transit ads. They wouldn't let atheist ads go up, but they did let religious ads go up. I wouldn't call it a total victory because we didn't get the atheist ads up, but they did agree not to run religious ads at all. So that's a victory. We supposedly or apparently cleaned up the ads there. I know we have some people from Pittsburgh here, so keep an eye on your transit system. Let us know if you do see any religious ads, because they would violate the consent decree. Douglas County, Colorado, we're still going on in a case there, but we settled it partially against one of the schools in the school system there, a charter school, to keep religion out. These are all victories that we've had. I did put, you know, the label says recent notables, not just recent victories. So I did put a couple down at the bottom there in Massachusetts and New Jersey. Those are really our only judgments that have been losses, and those are not even Establishment Clause cases. This is cases I'm sure some of you are familiar with, the equal protection strategy that we tried in Massachusetts and New Jersey. It was really a very, I think, kind of creative and newfangled approach to the Pledge of Allegiance issue by arguing it not through the Establishment Clause, but by saying, no, judge, don't even look at the Establishment Clause. Please consider this challenge through the eyes of equal protection, that the Pledge of Allegiance discriminates against atheist students by declaring that the nation is under God and defining patriotism in theistic terms, thereby portraying the non-theistic student as less patriotic. We thought it was a great strategy, and we really put a lot into it. Unfortunately, the judges didn't think it was such a great strategy. They shot us down both in Massachusetts and New Jersey.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. In this show, we're listening to a presentation from David Niosi and Monica Miller on the Epignani Humanist Legal Center.
I would still put those as notable. It was really an effort by the AHA to cut some new law, but didn't go our way. But again, those are not Establishment Clause cases. So at this point, as far as final judgments go and settlements, we are batting 1,000 on Establishment Clause cases. So something to be proud of as a group. We'll take questions at the end, if you don't mind. Just we do have some material to get through, and I'd be glad to take questions, but I just want to try to get this. And Monica has some things to present as well. As far as the Legal Center goes, there is your team. There's myself and Monica. Kat Page is in D.C. She's not out here, but she's holding down the fort there. Kat just joined the Legal Center within the last year. And very importantly, you'll note on the right, it says the Legal Society, Secular Legal Society Cooperating Lawyers. The Secular Legal Society is really an important aspect of the AHA's legal center. What it is, let me just go into a little bit of detail about it. Right now, we have a list of about 165 lawyers from around the country who are members of the Secular Legal Society. If there are any lawyers in the audience who are not members of the SLS already and you're interested, please come see me. There's no real obligation to be a member of the SLS, but what we do hope is that if we need a little advice or something, we can turn to you for whatever your breadth of knowledge is and whatever way you might be able to help. We certainly don't expect people to sacrifice greatly. But we have lawyers in virtually any specialty you could imagine. There are SLS lawyers who do real estate, criminal defense, intellectual property, immigration, you name it. There's just about, if there's a legal specialty, we probably have somebody who does it. And we cover pretty much the country as well. We ask the SLS lawyers to assist us in various ways. We, for example, have people who have helped seculars with immigration issues. We have turned to them for copyright questions that the AHA might have some sort of copyright questions. Our celebrants often find difficulty around the country getting recognized to have the right to do weddings. Our SLS lawyers have helped us for that. Sometimes we just turn to them to help us find local counsel or to serve as local counsel if we want to file a suit. There's just innumerable ways that having a team of lawyers around the country helps us. Very importantly, we also can ask them to do volunteer work for us if they're interested. One SLS lawyer, Gordon Gamm, drafted a heck of an amicus brief to file at the Supreme Court in connection with the Zubik case, the challenge of the contraception mandate. And unlike some amicus briefs, which basically parrot what one of the parties is saying and, you know, doesn't really present anything new, Gordon's brief presented the whole issue from the standpoint of a humanist, of this is how humanists see this issue, and this is how the issue would be approached. And it really is going to open some eyes at the Supreme Court as they read that. And he brings in the issue of religion and why religion really is such a factor in a policy issue like this. So this is great stuff. So we welcome that sort of thing. Now, most of our SLS lawyers assist us in a pro bono sense, but I put there, but not always. In fact, sometimes when we need local counsel to serve, to help us get into a jurisdiction, that local counsel will assist us with the case. For example, out in Oregon, when we filed that case, there was a lawyer out in Oregon who served as our host there, and he did some of the litigation work for us. Those local counsels, when we win these cases, the constitutional, the statute that allows us to pursue civil rights also allows us to recover attorney's fees, including attorney's fees for local counsel. So we have had SLS lawyers make a pretty good fee on some of these cases by standing in there with us and helping us fight on behalf of church-state separation. So it's a win-win situation. As far as our areas of activity, by and far the area that we spend the most time on is litigation. We are, as I described at the beginning, really a litigation shop, and we've got cases all over the country, and we are litigating them in-house. We are filing the complaints. We are doing the discovery. If you're familiar with the litigation process, propounding interrogatories, requesting documents, responding to such requests from the other side, conducting depositions, filing motions, arguing motions, and going all the way to judgment if the cases don't settle. So it's really very much a litigation-heavy shop, and that's what we do. We do some other stuff, too, non-litigation advocacy. I'm going to get into that after Monica talks, and also education and activism. These are things that we also focus on and we spend a fair amount of time on, but I want to save that for the end. But Needless to say, we're very, very busy. This is a list of our current pending cases. As you can see, we've got the country pretty much covered, although the bulk of the work tends to be down in the Bible Belt. No surprise there. There are church-state violations all over the country, though. Don't be fooled into thinking that it's only a red state issue. Not even close. We've got these cases, and all of our cases currently are in federal court, mostly in federal district court, but we do have some cases up in the circuits as well with appellate work. So at this point, just to go into a little bit more detail on our current docket, I want to ask Monica to come up, and she'll talk about these a little bit more.
Hello, I am Monica, and I'm going to discuss briefly, like Dave said, each of the current cases that we have pending. So the first case that I'm going to talk about is Birdville ISD, and this is a school district in Texas. And I don't know if any of you were here last year, but we gave an award to Isaiah Smith, who at the time we were acknowledging the fact that he stood up against his school for ripping his Bible and then being punished for that. So we sent a cease and desist. But actually, this lawsuit involves school board prayers. The school board there has been selecting and handpicking elementary school children to deliver prayers before their school board meetings. And they've been doing this for, I think, over about 20 years. And so we filed a lawsuit to stop this practice and to, you know, make sure that they're not endorsing prayer in schools. And what they're trying to argue is that this is akin to legislative prayer. I'm not sure if you all are familiar with the Town of Greece decision, but the Supreme Court has tried to exempt legislative prayers, i.e. those that are delivered in chambers, you know, Congress or state legislature. It has extended that to local city councils, but a school board is a school board. It's not a city council. That's our argument, that students and teachers are present, and it's really a school function, and so that exception should not apply. This is the Bladensburg Cross. It sits in Maryland, and we are arguing that this is a Christian cross. And surprisingly, that is a controversial statement because the district court recently ruled against us that this somehow does not endorse Christianity. So there's that. We have appealed this case to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. We filed our brief, I think about a couple months ago is our last brief that we filed. So we'll probably hear from the court soon as to whether it's going to hear oral arguments as to the cross's constitutionality. The American Legion intervened early on in the case. And so it's predominant. This is probably one of the most David and Goliath situations I've faced so far. We had depositions in their fancy DC law firm. And it's me and the local counsel, and then the whole other table is full of their counsel for the American Legion. So that was an experience, but we shall see. And this is Carroll County, Maryland. This is a case that we've had going on for quite some time now. I believe we filed it back in 2013, May 2013, so 3 years ago. This is a legislative prayer case. This is a city council that's been delivering legislative prayers for a long time, and often the prayers are proselytizing and are basically a way for the city council members to let everyone know that they're very Christian. And we filed this case before the Town of Greece decision, which changed the legal landscape a little bit by saying that certain types of prayers are okay, but certain types are not. And so in our case, that sort of shifted the arguments, and we are waiting for the Fourth Circuit to decide another case that involves a similar issue, which is that the city council members themselves versus any citizen that wants to come in are delivering the prayers. And we think that's more problematic because when you see your own mayor or city council member stand up and, you know, hail to Jesus and, you know, kind of give a little soapbox spiel on Jesus, it feels a little bit more like your government's endorsing that view versus if a pastor comes in through a rotating roster of people, anyone could deliver a prayer, as in Town of Greece, where an atheist even could deliver that. That's not the case in Carroll County, Maryland. This is part two of the Douglas County case that Dave mentioned briefly, that we did reach a settlement with one of the schools that were involved in this case, and this stems from Colorado. We were initially contacted by a parent after they discovered that their school was soliciting them for donations to Operation Christmas Child, which is run by Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham. And what they do is they take presents to children in developing countries and use them as a bribe to preach and proselytize Christianity. And their goal is conversion. And they've infiltrated the schools. We've seen this in South Carolina as well. But they do, the school was using school resources and inducing children to participate in Operation Christmas Child and to donate their money. And then after we sent them a letter, we found out that they were also, the same school district was also sending children to Guatemala for a mission trip through another Christian evangelical organization called Adventures in Missions. And they too are involved in conversion and proselytization. And school teachers were involved in that and were clearly endorsing Christianity with the students on the trip. And the parent that had a student in the school was asked to give money and toys and things that were directly going towards those conversion efforts. And so we have challenged this, and we actually haven't lost on the merits. The court said that the parents weren't injured enough by being asked to donate to Franklin Graham's organization and to Adventures in Missions. We think that that decision is clearly wrong, and I think we're at least likely to, on remand, have standing and then go to the merits of the case. This is another longstanding case. This too was filed in 2013. This is our Greenville County School District case, and I actually just recently came back from the Fourth Circuit for oral arguments in this case, and that was our second time to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals for the same case. And this is a very troubling situation because not only is the school district having prayers being delivered in their graduation ceremonies, but they're also holding the elementary school graduation ceremonies and several other school district functions within a Christian chapel within this very evangelical Baptist university called North Greenville University. So elementary students, public school graduation entails sitting, listening to two Christian prayers and being surrounded by Jesus and stained glass windows. So it very much feels like a religious event and not a public school graduation ceremony. We didn't win. And this is another one kind of like the Bladensburg cross where we're just shaking our heads. You know, how does this happen? But, you know, we'll see what the Fourth Circuit has to say and go from there. This is another case involving a public school. As you can see, public schools are a big source of constitutional violations, and it is a place that we think is also very important for us to intervene so that students are able to learn in an environment that is free from the government telling them what to believe and what not to believe as far as religion goes. Joplin School District, similar to Greenville, has been sending students to this Christian ministry gym function conglomerate. It's a gym, but it has Jesus banners and Christian messages all throughout the facility. And their goals, this facility, is to, you know, exalt Jesus and basically also serve a conversion platform for students to find Jesus. So we think that it's unconstitutional for a school district to be sending children to such a venue, especially in light of so many alternatives, including miniature golf, and they had a lot of alternatives. So this is a similar case. In North Carolina, it's similar to the Oregon case that Dave discussed, which involved a humanist prisoner. This too involves a humanist prisoner, but he is in state prison, not federal prison, because if it were federal prison, we'd go in with our now consent decree and we'd say you have to recognize humanism. But North Carolina is not bound by the same consent decree, so we have initiated a case on behalf of humanists that are in North Carolina prison systems so that they can practice their they can have meetings just like the other groups can have meetings. So there's a Christian Bible study. These humanists now can have their meetings. They can identify. We were asking the court that they can be able to identify as humanists just like the federal inmates now can. And so far, this case hasn't gone to summary judgment or trial yet. So we're still in the discovery phase. And Ocala, Florida is a pretty different case. It's not involving the schools, public schools. It is involving a community prayer vigil held by the city of Ocala and their police department. Happened a couple years, we filed the case in 2014, so a little over 2 years. The city held this vigil and police officers were in their uniform and they you know, asked people to come out and to pray for, you know, the community. And we had sent, Dave actually sent them a letter saying that this would be wrong and that they couldn't endorse the prayer vigil. And the mayor's response was, you know, not only are we not going to, you know, stop doing this, I'm going to encourage more people to come. So of course we're like, well, I guess we have to see them. And let's see, Pensacola. This is a recent case we just filed a couple weeks ago. I think not even, 2 weeks ago. In Florida, as you can see, and it too is a Christian cross, or so we think. And who knows anymore? This is a case that we have actually jointly filed with the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So it's the first case that we've done a joint lawsuit with another secular organization. We don't have the organizations listed as plaintiffs. We have the local citizens listed as plaintiffs, but we think it's a great opportunity for us to do some, you know, teamwork with the other organization and you know, work together on an issue that we both feel passionate about. And so this case, like I said, we just filed it, so there's no trial or anything, but you know, I mean, if a court in Maryland is going to say a Christian cross isn't Christian, I suspect that in the Deep South, we might get a similar conclusion. I don't know. And so I think that wraps up my discussion on the cases, and I will turn it back over to Dave.
One thing that you may have noticed just running through that list of cases is I think when a lot of people think about church-state separation, the first thing that comes to mind is things like, oh, in God we trust, we got to get rid of that motto, these national, federal issues, the religious right is so strong and they're powerful in Washington and all that. But if you really think about it, where the action is on these cases is in local communities. That's where the wall of separation is being violated most brazenly and most openly and with the sense that no one's going to dare challenge us. You know, there's this majoritarian feel in a lot of these communities that we're a Christian community here, and if you don't like it, leave.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. In this show, we're listening to a presentation from David Niosi and Monica Miller on the Epignani Humanist Legal Center.
That really is the sense. We're not suing the United States here. We did in Oregon, but that was kind of the exception. We're suing the Joplin School District. We're suing the city of Ocala, mayors and police chiefs and school superintendents. That's where the action is, and that's where we're fighting the battles. And, you know, we all live in a local community somewhere. And I would suggest, you know, keep your eyes and ears open and learn what's happening in your town. You never know where the next church state violation might come from. Another thing about this whole area that I've discovered working in this area for a few years is that the sense nationally is that things are in the courts are kind of moving in a progressive direction. You know, the LGBT movement has made a lot of progress. We've seen just revolutionary change there. In the area of church-state separation, I would suggest to you that even amongst liberals, there seems to be almost like a folding of the tents sometimes. We've turned to liberals and asked for assistance. We've reached out on church-state issues, and there's sometimes no interest. We've turned to the gay rights movement, for example, saying, hey, you won the Boy Scouts. Now it's time for atheists. We can't give in to the Boy Scouts yet because they still don't let atheists in. Not so much interest in that. What's the big deal about a prayer at graduation? Well, you know, the Supreme Court said back in the 90s that graduation prayer is just not allowed, period. But even amongst liberals, you'll think now, well, isn't there like a free speech zone? The problem with a lot of this is what happened with passage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act back in the early 90s. The sense that religious freedom is now more exalted than ever has also caused even liberals, I think, to think that maybe the wall of separation isn't quite as high as we once thought it was. You know, if the Supreme Court has said graduation prayers just aren't allowed, there should be no question, especially on the liberal side, that graduation prayers just aren't allowed. Instead, you see many of these communities, we were dealing with it just within the last couple weeks, and in the Greenville case, that these schools, despite what the Supreme Court said, can now say, well, we're not going to have a prayer, but we're going to have somebody offer some thoughts at the beginning of graduation, and we're not going to tell them what to say. And since we're not regulating what they say, if they choose to pray, well, that's a free speech principle, and that's their free speech. Obviously, they're just setting everything up to get around the ruling that the Supreme Court said. But you will see even many liberals, even many progressives, say, well, you know, free speech. There really is no conflict between free speech and freedom of religion and the Establishment Clause, but we've allowed that conflict to be created through the over-exaltation of religious freedom, and it really started with RFRA, or the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So it's something to be aware of in your communities, and don't give into it. You may find even many allies are going to tolerate infringement on church-state separation, and we can't give in. We really are on the right side of this issue. So anyway, I said that I was going to have a few words about the other activity besides all that litigation that Monica just ran through. And our non-litigation activity is quite extensive as well. We send out complaint letters all the time. This is just a little sampling here of the kind of stuff that we send out. We sent a letter to the Arizona Senate because they wouldn't allow a non-theistic legislator to give a secular invocation or humanist invocation in Mississippi. There's a teacher who put up a prayer request board in her room. You know, what's wrong with that? Isn't that the teacher's religious freedom to do that? No, it's not. That was the argument coming back. And we got that prayer request board taken down with a simple letter. We didn't have to file a lawsuit. We sent a letter saying, I shouldn't say just saying, because Monica's letters never just say. Well, they're like 12 pages long, citing. But she said a lot. But to sum it up is that violates the Establishment Clause. And they took the board down. In Kansas, we stopped some Bible distribution. There's a lot of that going around in this country. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it seems like the Gideons and others feel that public schools were built so that they could distribute Bibles and religious material. But we stop it when we can, but we need eyes and ears on the ground to let us know that it's happening in your town. We can swoop in, and usually without filing a lawsuit, get it stopped. They try very hard to get around that as well, though. What they'll say is, oh, we let any religious organization come in and leave their literature and distribute their literature. Although I bet, you know, if the Satanic Church came in, they wouldn't be welcome quite as much as or for that matter, if the American Humanist Association came in and offered some Good Without God pamphlets. I doubt if we'd see the kindergarten teachers, blocking out 10 minutes of their time to help distribute that stuff, which is what happens with the Bible distribution. So more than anything else when it comes to complaint letters, though, it's our pledge boycott. I assume most of you are somewhat familiar with that, but the American Humanist Association has really connected with young people in this country by informing them and raising awareness of the fact that they can't be forced to pledge allegiance. This issue transcends just the obvious under God issue. I think we're all aware of that. And the idea of the boycott is to boycott the pledge until under God is taken out. A lot of us feel that the idea of pledging allegiance just kind of rubs us the wrong way anyway. And for whatever reason, any child wishes to be out of the pledge exercise in his or her school, we are there to defend them immediately. And we get contacted by middle school kids. I think the youngest we've seen is sixth grade. But we get middle school kids, high school kids. We have really heard some horror stories of teachers badgering kids and really humiliating them in front of their class and in front of their school. And we send a letter that is the appropriate response to that kind of behavior. And I'm happy to say we have not even had to file suit on one of these cases yet. And we've sent how many, Monica? Probably, yeah. It's we're probably over 100 in terms of that. We get contacted all the time by kids all over the country, and whenever we send these letters, we very soon thereafter almost always get an apologetic letter from the superintendent or the school's general counsel saying, "Sorry, won't happen again. It was just misunderstanding." Yeah, it was a misunderstanding, wasn't it? And we've had schools apologize. We've almost never, I don't think we've ever had a school come right back and say, "Get lost, we're making this kid pledge." That they sometimes they ignore us for a while, but if we contact the kid and the kid tells us that there's still a problem, we'll follow up. And the follow-up is almost never necessary because the law is so clear. In 1943, in the Barnett case, the Supreme Court said that as a matter of free speech, children cannot be forced to even stand up for the pledge. They can't be forced to pledge allegiance, and they can't be forced to commit any act that amounts to participation in the exercise. So it's all good there. And that's at this point, it's all non-litigation advocacy because we haven't had to litigate one. The law is so strong, and no school system has been stupid enough to challenge it. So as I mentioned earlier, we also get involved in celebrant recognition when celebrants have a hard time, especially in Virginia for some reason. There seems to be a lot of trouble with celebrants getting recognized to officiate weddings. It's county by county down there, and sometimes you just get some bad counties. But we've been successful in everyone so far. And amicus briefs, as I mentioned earlier. And we also do, panels and do speaking and that sort of thing. We'll gladly visit your chapter and that sort of thing if there's if we can make it work schedule-wise. And let's see. Oh, this is just an example of the greeting that you get if you're a legislator or a public official violating church-state separation. That is about, I would say, 5% of a typical Monica letter. We send a very serious letter usually, letting them know whatever they're doing is wrong. And fortunately, it's not always necessary to file suit. What's that? Yes, yes, exactly. So other things that we do, Monica and I in all our spare time put together a continuing legal education course last year. We actually got it accredited by the state of Minnesota, and we did the class, I think it was last summer or last spring, and we are probably going to do it again. We did that in connection with the Humanist Institute, and it was a fun exercise, and I think it was helpful. We'd certainly like to do more of it. There's a lot of stuff we'd like to do more of, but obviously resources and staffing are the challenge. The Secular Legal Society that I mentioned earlier, one thing that we'd like to do with that I didn't mention is the idea of expanding that. Or if you're familiar at all with the legal world, you're probably familiar with the Federalist Society on the conservative side. It's a society that Justice Scalia actually helped nurture and grow into a very powerful force in this country. I think several of the Supreme Court justices now are still members of the Federalist Society. But basically what it is, it's a network of conservative lawyers who have this supposedly originalist view of the Constitution, and they have chapters in many law schools, probably most law schools at this point in time. Judges belong to it, lawyers belong to it, and law students belong to it. And they use it as a incubator, if you will, to strategize for their judicial philosophy and how to get it implemented, how to hone it, and just be effective as conservative jurists. And I don't think there's much arguing that they've been pretty successful. The judiciary, generally speaking, has gone to the right. So what we're thinking is we need a counterpart to that, a secular legal society. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have SLS chapters in law schools all over the country with people going to law school and coming out and kind of really seeing themselves as attached to this movement, this humanist movement, the secular movement, and working on the jurisprudence and honing the arguments, building the network, probably most important than anything, having judges and professors and lawyers, of course, all over the country attached to the SLS. So this is something that we can envision. We certainly would need more resources to do it, but it's a vision that we have. And we have started, you know, just taking baby steps in the direction of trying to get it done, building relationships through the Secular Student Alliance, for example. They have some law school chapters. And I hope in a few years' time I can talk to you again and talk about maybe some progress that we've made in that regard. Anyway, that is the AHLC activity in a nutshell. Now you can understand why I couldn't tell you everything in the 3 minutes that I had at the membership meeting yesterday. We've been very busy with a lot of stuff, and we'd be glad to take any questions in the remaining time that we have.
If you have any questions, we have a few minutes. You can just line up. We only have about 5 minutes, so we're not going to be able to take everybody.
Arthur Jackson, a question on this. Would a judge who's involved in the thing you mentioned have to recluse themselves for a case that that involved that issue?
You're talking about the Federalist Society, those judges?
Right, yes.
Not really. It's very rare for judges to recuse themselves. Just because they happen to belong to a conservative club doesn't mean that they can't rule on issues where it's, you know, it's a judgment call, conservative or liberal, or whatever. No. Short answer is no.
Hi, David. The Happy Human Book Club in Davenport, Iowa just finished reading Non-Believer Nation, and we enjoyed it very much. Thank you. I think the biggest debate we had was how to pronounce your last name. But my question is, I was invited to speak to a local city council in Western Illinois, and after ringing the bell 3 times, which seemed very ritualistic to me, they all stood for the pledge, and then I sat down. But to my horror, they went on and had a minister there who had this lengthy prayer about invoking Jesus to guide them on their journey and all of the people in the community to come to Jesus to make it a better place for everyone. And it went on and on in a horrifying way. But are you saying that they are protected and able to do that?
Legislative prayer is in some ways still up in the air. The original legislative prayer case was Ernie Chambers' case from back, I think it was 1983. And the ruling out of that and the way that everyone interpreted that ruling is that legislative prayer is a rare exception under Establishment Clause law, where it doesn't even get analyzed with the usual test that Establishment Clause cases get analyzed with. Instead, we're just going to recognize that there's this rare tradition that's been around since the beginning, and we're going to let it go. But the sense was that it would only be non-sectarian prayer that would be allowed, because that was the kind of prayer that Chambers challenged in the Nebraska legislature. Now, that was the case for decades until Greece came down a couple years ago, where this Supreme Court said, we're going to allow sectarian prayer now. And it creeps into what I was talking about earlier about freedom of religion and giving the speaker the latitude to say what the speaker wants. In Greece, it was invited clergy who were allowed to come in, and the court noted that. So as long as invited clergy are brought in and they're not really disparaging towards minority religions, and they're not basically all fire and brimstone, that sort of thing. Even sectarian prayer is allowed, but the assumption now is that only invited clergy. What Greece seems to say is that you cannot have legislative prayer where the legislators themselves are leading the prayers, especially sectarian prayers. That's what our Carroll County case involves, and that's where the law is at now. So despite the Chambers case and despite Greece, there's still some uncertainty about what exactly is allowed and not allowed. But these issues, I think, are going to be resolved, maybe mostly through the circuit courts. But our sense is that legislators themselves have not been given the green light to lead prayers.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.